Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. We are in our final round of appearances by the New York City mayoral hopefuls, and this is our call-in round. All the major candidates are coming on to answer your questions. Next week, mark your calendars, we will have Bill Thompson, Bill de Blasio, and Christine Quinn. They're all lined up. We heard yesterday from John Liu, last week from Joe Loda and John Katsimatidis on the Republican side. You can check out the ones that have already aired on our webpage if you're still candidate shopping in either primary and want a closer listen. And right now, it's Democratic hopeful Anthony Weiner. You can call in right now at 212-433-WNYC. And let me just say up front, listeners, that we will deal with the sexting scandal because that's obviously an issue in the race. But we will make sure to talk about the issues facing the city as well. So if you all call on the scandal, many of you will get bumped by our screeners. Just saying. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Anthony Weiner, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
And I'll ask you a few questions while the calls are coming in. Why would you make a better mayor than Bill de Blasio?
Well, Bill de Blasio, Christine Quinn, Bill Thompson, John Liu, they're all part of the primordial ooze of municipal governance over the last 10, 15, 20 years. To some degree, they all are continuations of what we have. If people like basically where things are and where they're going, then they should choose one of the other candidates. I'm not going to go in that direction. I can tell you they're all trying to line up support in the same traditional old Democrat way, which is trying to line up endorsements, trying to line up famous people to stand next to them. I've tried to run a campaign based on ideas, two idea books, 125 new ideas, and again, kind of making my case directly to citizens based on problem solving, not based on endorsements.
Your late entry made it hard for you to get those endorsements. You wouldn't have gone for them if you were in the race earlier?
No, in 2005, I ran arguably for 2 years, ran the same type of campaign, didn't have no institutional support. And look, my point isn't that I dishonor those people that are in those organizations or the organizations themselves. It's just a different way of running races. We've lost campaigns for 24 years in this city because we all – it seems like every 4 years we do the exact same thing. Press conferences on the steps of City Hall, people wearing the same color T-shirts. And that doesn't speak to what modern Democrats want, which is ideas, problem solving for the middle class and those struggling to make it.
De Blasio has embraced the most liberal candidate label, especially on inequality. And you have not tried to embrace that label. John Liu is the other one trying to, despite your very liberal reputation in Congress on many things. Should New York Democrats not select the most liberal candidate?
I don't know what it means anymore. I mean, to be honest with you, I advocate for a single-payer health care system. Most conservative people who want to spend less money on health care should embrace that because it's – I mean, I'm the candidate who has the most far-reaching maternity leave proposal of all the candidates, 3 months paid maternity leave for people that work for the city. I just don't know what these labels mean anymore. Yesterday, I came out with a proposal to reorganize the way we do transaction tax on real estate. So anyone who is buying real estate of less than $500,000 pays nothing, but these oligarchs that park their money in the city paying multi-million dollar apartments, they'll pay a little bit more. I don't know if that's conservative or liberal, but I can tell you this. These are innovative ideas to try to solve problems, which is something I'm doing to a much greater degree than any other campaign.
Let's take a phone call. Your calls for Anthony Weiner. Billy in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hello, Billy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Weiner, I'm an undecided voter, and I'm 25 years old and been living in New York for quite some time. And I actually very much appreciate the ideas that you are working with currently, and I find them to be pretty interesting, especially as a younger independent voter. My biggest question to you is, if you were to be elected, and I know that you're probably very tired of hearing about this, how effective do you feel you would be, and do you feel you would be hamstrung by your own personal trials in really making these ideas into realities? Because so far, the younger political-minded people, I find a lot of the Democratic ideology to be just that, and I find that it has a hard time getting put into place. And how would you make these ideas a reality with respect to the trials that you already have to overcome currently?
Billy, what could you get more specific? How do you think his personal trials would affect his ability to carry out his ideas?
I am of the mindset that even though personal and political aspirations should stay separate, I think that a lot of people have a hard time going through and making that sort of distinction. So how are your ideas going to be able to go through all of the all of the people that currently stand in your way and really become
all right.
big changes for New Yorkers today?
Billy, thank you.
Well, I think Billy raises an interesting point. You know, what do we learn from campaigns? And I think what I want people to learn from this campaign is that, one, obviously, these embarrassing things in my personal life that are in my past have now come up. But I want people to also judge the way I've dealt with this adversity. I haven't ducked. I've gone out and I've continued my public schedule. I've kept talking about ideas. Every single day I'm out there talking about ideas. If people want to talk about my private life, they're welcome to do it. But people want to talk about my ideas, I'm going to be ready. And I've been under an enormous amount of pressure, arguably presidential-level scrutiny over these things. And I think that I've shown that I'm pretty tough. I think I'm willing to stand in. I don't think I've ducked a single debate, ducked a single subway station. I've been out there fighting for these things. And I think that if I am successful in this campaign, I think it would say to a lot of people, look, if you want to keep talking about someone's private life, you're welcome to do it, but it is not going to slow up the voters from choosing the candidate with the best ideas.
Many people have felt that you lied to the public in your People magazine interview last summer when you said, it took a lot of work to get to where we are today, but I want people to know we're a normal family. Maybe not so normal at that time with what's been revealed. But the point for the public is that that discrepancy makes people not trust you. What would you say to put voters more at ease with that, if anything?
Well, you know, Hume and I also sat down for an 8,500-word article in the New York Times Magazine where he said very clearly that these things were in our rearview mirror.
There's
no doubt about it. It seems like the most valuable lesson I learned here is that while I thought as I was working through these personal challenges in my life, the fact that it was behind me, I got into the race, I said they were behind me and they were, people apparently wanted to know with much more precision exactly where they were behind me. And so this was a year ago. It is true it happened after my resignation from Congress. These were challenging things to work through, and I did the very best that I could to explain to people when I got in the race that these things were behind me, that I had done them, I owned the responsibility for them, and I'd done a lot of work to get them into my background. And if people want, you know, people now know embarrassing things about my background. There's no doubt about it. And maybe that's what they believe should be their final determination. But if they believe that having someone who fights for new ideas and wants to solve problems is important, too, I want to offer them that.
But my question was about honesty. Were you trying to mislead people last summer in People magazine into believing that it all was behind you at that time when it wasn't?
Well, no. I mean, look. This was a continuum of challenges that I had that I tried to speak about as frankly and honestly as I could at all steps of the way. If the impression I left in People magazine was that I was then a perfect, cured, healthy, 100% person with everything in order, I wasn't. I was still working through things at that time. When I got in the race, which was long after that or months after that, you know, that a lot of work had been done and that I did have these things behind me. The one thing that hasn't changed and that I was honest about, when I got in this campaign, I said it to you. I said, I did these things. They were in my past. I did them repeatedly with more than one person. I deeply regretted them. And I also deeply regret that this element of my private life has been so difficult for people to get past.
Dina at Columbus Circle. You're on WNYC with Anthony Weiner. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Mr. Weiner, I just wanted to know, for example, like Mayor Bloomberg always spoke out on issues that didn't necessarily affect New York, you know, Manhattan, the five boroughs. Like, for example, no one spoke out against the 104 terrorists that were forced by Obama to be released in Israel. I'm just wondering, you're so vocal and you're so strong, would you have any trepidation on speaking out on issues that may not be politically advantageous to you, but just because it's the right thing to do?
Let me just first get your take on the fact that she presented it, or the interpretation of what's happening in the Middle East as she presented it, that President Obama forced Israel to release 104 terrorists. Is that your interpretation of what's going on there right now?
Look, unfortunately, that the cost of getting to a deal in the Middle East, the Israelis came to the conclusion, was releasing terrorists. That is a jarring thing to have to do. It is something that I think is wrong. I don't think that someone who's a terrorist in jail should be released as the price for doing business. That, unfortunately, is the state of play. Now, I've made a career of standing up not only for issues important to Israel, but also, frankly, standing up for things important for New York City, even when they weren't popular. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples. When I was a member of Congress, you know, my district was hardly a bastion of people who believe strongly in comprehensive immigration reform or national health care. I represent a district that only 55% voted for President Obama. I tried to lead by leading, by arguing that these things were good for my constituents and good for the city, even though they might have disagreed with it. And I also did it in a very open way, you know, 25 town hall meetings on Obamacare and on my plans for single payer health care. And I think I brought people along. At least I honored their objections and tried to lead them.
So on the current Mideast peace process that Secretary Kerry is trying to lead, do you think it's being done well and at the right time?
I unfortunately don't believe that there is sufficient leadership on the Palestinian side right now. However, you've got to do what you got to do everything that you can. I mean, we do have the problem in Gaza that is represented by a terrorist organization, and it's not really clear how strong Mahmoud Abbas is and his ability to get any deal done. We have to realize the sands of time move much slower in that part of the world. And just because we're in the second term of presidential election doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to find peace there.
And before we leave the region, even though it isn't really a mayoral campaign issue, do you support U.S. military action in Syria?
Well, I do think if the United Nations is good for anything, it has to be in moments when chemical weapons are being used by a country against its people.
But Russia will veto it.
No, I understand that, which is why my caveat was if the United Nations is good for anything. I mean, this is the problem. The United Nations is now just has become a fairly feckless organization because you've got the Russians and the Chinese standing in the way of doing anything that is not in their oil interests.
Robert in Rideau Park. You're on WNYC. Hello, Robert.
Brian, how you doing, guy? Mr. Wiener, I'd like to first say that there's not one human being in the world who has not performed an action that is not in relationship to God. So you're a good guy and just continue on what you're doing. My question is this. According to the New York Times, 46,000 New York City residents make $1 million or more. Most people in the city do not realize, and you guys do, that it's the state legislature who allows this monopoly, this outrageous thing to continue with. There's no progressive tax. It's outrageous. The city needs billions of dollars. My question is, how do you get the state legislature, the mayor, to do the right thing?
Well, first of all, it's true. And one of the things that I argue consistently in this campaign, Robert, is that we have too passively sat by while we let Albany dictate so much of our lives. There might have been a time in New York civic life when Albany was the better governing agency than the city of New York. That doesn't exist anymore. But the first thing you've got to do is try. You know, I think that I haven't heard Mike Bloomberg talk very much about the challenges facing the middle class and those struggling to make it, or the notion that we should always try to make our tax system more progressive. I support a 10% tax cut for the middle class, people making less than $150,000 a year. You can pay for it with a 1% increase on those making $1 million or more. Even just taxing these Russian oligarchs who buy these multi-million-dollar condos and pay the same tax rate as a homeowner in Jackson Heights, even things like that. I think ultimately the state legislature wants to do the right thing. The fact that senators from Syracuse get to decide tax policy on Eastern Parkway makes no sense to me, though.
And to the issue of the progressive taxation that he raises, Bill de Blasio is getting a lot of attention for saying that he would raise the city income tax on New Yorkers making $500,000 a year or more and use all the extra revenue to guarantee universal full-day pre-K in the city. Yes, the state legislature would have to approve that proposal. Would you also raise taxes on the highest earners?
Yes, I would raise them 1%. I actually proposed it first in 2005, and I also the oligarch tax that I proposed yesterday. It would eliminate real estate transaction taxes on people who sell homes for less than $500,000, but increase it to make it more progressive. And by the way, I happen to think I'm not going to vote for Bill de Blasio. I'm going to vote for me, but I think he's going to be successful in getting his plan passed because ultimately, making more progressive tax is the right thing to do for our city and our state.
And how would you use the revenue And what do you think about his idea to devote it all to universal full-day pre-K?
I'm very suspicious of dedicated taxes. We learned in the days, you know, for generations, the lottery money is dedicated towards certain things. It's very difficult to do that. I think that, that generally people are skeptical of the notion of dedicated taxes. My plan would create a tax progressivity. It would save money, and ultimately, I would like to use that to reduce the size of our government ultimately. But it allows me to do some of the other things that I've proposed. I mean, so, you know, frankly, even the single payer healthcare system saves us a lot of money.
Rudy in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Anthony Weiner. Hello, Rudy.
Hello. I happen to be Jewish, and Mr. Weiner, I've been following you for many years. And it's always upset me very much that I've never heard you express any sympathy whatsoever for the Palestinians and for the plight that they have. Why are you so Israel? You think Israel never does anything wrong? Are you at all familiar with the brutality that they
I just want to say, because I do call out listeners when they call under false premises and tell our screeners one thing and then go on the air with another, that Rudy said he wanted to ask a question about legalizing marijuana. but to his point, very briefly, are you too strong on Israel and ignore the rights of the Palestinians?
I believe Israel is our ally in the region. Israel is a democracy in a sea of violent dictatorships. My default position is to support Israel, but they certainly are not without flaw.
And John Liu is the only candidate in the race, to pick up his false premises question, who has called for legalizing marijuana for recreational use in New York. Do you support that?
I wouldn't go that far. What I would say is that I would tell my police department I don't want a focus of enforcement to be, you know, people caught with small amounts of marijuana. Part of the reasons why stops and frisks are up so much is because police officers are trying to get people to take marijuana out of their pocket and show it to be able to get that. There is 30% of all people who are arrested for that. It's their only offense. But I wouldn't go far as to legalize it.
Frank in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with Anthony Weiner. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say, you know, in the last debate, I felt like you were really overshadowed by the by your comment about poor people or whatever you said. But I wasn't offended by that. I was in awe of your universal health care plan because, you know, I would think every progressive politician in the country should be pushing for this. And then to follow up on the last caller, I just want to know how you feel about the fact that the disparity is 6 African-Americans to 1 white person for every marijuana offense.
Well, let me start with the first part. Look, I appreciate you making mention of the single-payer healthcare system. You know, just so your listeners understand, Brian, we spend an enormous amount of money in the city, $15 billion. We give about 20% of it to insurance companies right off the top. And we're closing hospitals at the same exact time. And so part of the reason is that we have bought into this model of having health insurance intermediaries that don't bring anything to the table. If we kept that money here, we could reopen hospitals, build our healthcare infrastructure. And as far as the disparity, there's no doubt about it. You know, part of the reason that the police department goes out and does so many stops of young men of color is they're looking for small amounts of marijuana to put people through the system. That will change under my police commissioner.
The single payer health plan. I think people don't understand it.
Yeah.
I don't understand it, honestly. When you propose a city-based single-payer health system in the context of the fact that we already have Medicare and Medicaid and we're going to have Obamacare and people have their private insurance at work, they're not all going to ditch all those things right for the Anthony Weiner single-payer plan, right?
Well, they could, but that's not the intention. Here's the universe that I'm talking about. We spend an enormous amount of money for healthcare. You and I do in form of taxes. We pay it for people who work for the city, retirees, people at the Health and Hospitals Corporation, the uninsured that we wind up paying for. We have a Department of Health. We have an enormous healthcare infrastructure in our city. Yet the way we administer most of it, 95% of it, is through one insurance company to provide care for all of those people. I want to cut out that insurance company. I want to manage it the way we might manage Medicare if we were doing it locally. That's not to say that seniors won't still have Medicare. Now, I say perhaps people could there's no reason once we create that system, we couldn't put it up on the exchange in the state and let people sign up for it, use our healthcare infrastructure here in the city. But the main thing that it would do, the main benefit that it would have for a lot of people is they wouldn't see a lot of change in their healthcare, but they would see that their tax burden would be reduced. And also I could take that money and devote it towards keeping hospitals open, really building hospitals up as a as an employer base. It is the second biggest employer in our city right now, and we're letting it wither on the vine.
On stop and frisk, if elected mayor, would you appeal the federal court ruling that stop and frisk as practiced is unconstitutional?
No. The only part of it that I would appeal is the monitor part. I would ask the monitor to give me a chance. Before we subject ourselves to a monitor, I would say, let me have my police commissioner come in. I'm the only candidate who has proposed a lapel camera that police officers would wear. It would protect the police officer from false accusations. It would record stops. In other localities where they have those cameras, the amount of invalid stops dramatically decline. Conflicts between police and the community dramatically declined, and the training has improved dramatically. I proposed that before the court ruling, and it's something now that the court has asked for also.
And would you have supported in city council the anti-racial profiling bill that would allow individuals who believe they were racially profiled by an officer to sue for damages in state court? We did a segment last hour with Murray Weiss, the criminal justice editor from DNA Info, who said he sees the union now basically telling them, hey, you know, don't get out there proactively and try to prevent crime because you're at risk of being sued.
I don't support either one of the bills because both of those are bills that we won't need under a new mayor. And I frankly think under any new mayor, perhaps with the exception of Christine Quinn, any new mayor I think would change those policies, particularly, I mean, if I'm assuming the Democrat gets elected. But I would say this. One of the things that we have to realize in all of this is an affirmative policy by Bloomberg and Kelly. They're making the decision to stop hundreds of thousands of people. They admit those people have done nothing wrong, and they say they're doing it as a deterrent. That is fundamentally unconstitutional. The court said it, but you didn't need a court to say that. I don't believe you need more legislation. You just need to stop that policy. And when you have such broad consensus that it should stop, when even the police department has started to reduce the stops, I believe creating a new cause of action, creating a new bureaucracy is not necessary.
And the mayor says the murder rate is going down even as the stop and frisk rate goes down because people are still afraid to go out on the street with their illegal weapons. If it really gets pulled back, then the weapons are going to proliferate again and the shootings
are
proliferate
again. No, do you know why the crime goes down when the number of stops goes down? Is because cops are not having interactions with innocent people anymore. They're out trying to find the bad guys. What people don't seem to understand, and the mayor, I think, has really dishonored this debate with the way he's talked about it, is this entire conversation is not about people that have guns or did something wrong or arrested. It's not about them. It's about people that he acknowledges, his lawyers acknowledge, the commissioner acknowledges have done nothing wrong. So if you have police officers interviewing those people, stopping them and frisking them, by definition, they're not out catching bad guys.
Joanne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Anthony Weiner. Hello.
Hi. Anthony Weiner, I think you've been a passionate, articulate supporter of my positions for a very long time. I've always been really happy to hear your ideas. In 2005, I guess it was, you were running for mayor, and I was ready to support you, and you left the race. I don't know why.
What's your question?
My question is, after then you became the senator, I was even more happy about that because I think we needed
senator,
that advocacy.
He was in the House.
How do I know? What is it? What is the motivation or what is keeping you from holding onto these positions or keeping the constituency happy and avoiding whatever the problems are that are making you leave these offices? Because I would like you to stick in one of these offices and bring your ideas forth.
I miss your Senate career?
I first of all, in 2005, not only did I run, I made the runoff. It's true. I chose not to contest the runoff that I thought unifying behind Fernando Ferrer against a billionaire was a virtuous thing to do. I don't regret that decision one bit. I went to Congress, fought very hard for single-payer health care, fought very hard for the stimulus bill. It was a moment in our American civic life where the action was really in Washington for a change, and I am very proud of my service there. Obviously, I've said it many times. I deeply regret the circumstances that required me to leave Congress. Now I'm the same person who fought for these same things. things, and I'm doing it now. And I just want people to see that if you want to see someone who has fought consistently for the same things, look at my record on single-payer health care throughout Congress, throughout now. I'm going to bring it to New York City. I am animated. You know, the New York Times criticized me for having the same positions in 2013 that I had when I ran in 2005. Well, that's exactly right. For the middle class and those struggling to make it, I want to be a champion.
But can we end on the polls, because you were leading in July until the news broke that your sexting continued for a year after you resigned from Congress. Now Quinnipiac has you in single digits. You can't ignore the fact that your personal life seems to be crashing your campaign. Can you get past it?
Well, look, when I got in the race, it was the same exact forces that were trying to hold me down. And steadily, as people heard my ideas, they came around to the place that, look, I know things about his personal life, but the things I know about his positions and what kind of fighter he is make me want to vote for him. I have to do that work again. That's why
forces holding you down. Are you blaming some outsiders for your status
right now? I'm just saying the very same editorial page writers, the very same newspapers, the very same people who have created this buffer between me and the voters. I've got to plow through now because I believe they want to talk about ideas. I believe they want to have conversations like this. And I want to tell you, Brian, I only have one gear, and it is to talk about issues important to the middle class, talk about substance. And I've tried to do it every single day, scandal or not, funny headlines about my name or not. I've kept on doing it, and that's what I'm going to keep doing right to the end.
Anthony Weiner, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our call-in round with the mayoral hopefuls continues on Tuesday. Our first guest after the Labor Day weekend, that'll be Tuesday morning at 10, will be Bill de Blasio, so join us again for that. And we continue in just a minute. Going back to the issue of Syria, we will have a Dante Cheney data crawl. The author of Patchwork Nation breaks down what kinds of American counties support U.S. military intervention in Syria and which kinds are opposed. Stay with us.